Welcome to Live from My Office. Steve Cochran here, and you're about to hear the full interview with former Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. McCarthy ended up losing his job running the Chicago Police Department over a police shooting a long time ago. Was he a scapegoat? Did he take one for the team? You could argue that on your side with whatever points you have. I happen to be a fan of McCarthy, the work he did here and the work he did as a cop around the country. He is someone who has walked the walk and knows the tale of what it takes to be a cop, the risk that you put into your job every single day, and the sacrifice your family makes, frankly, not knowing if you're coming home at night. Now, a week ago, there was a video release. It's a couple of weeks ago, as of the time we're taping this, which is on April 22nd. Whatever you listen to it, you may remember the name Dexter Reed. Dexter Reed was a bad guy in Chicago. Doesn't mean he should be dead, and I feel badly that he is. But he shot a cop who stopped him for completely appropriate reasons. And as they walked away, these cops continued to do the right thing until one was shot. They opened fire. Reed died. Kim Fox, the head of COPA, and the mayor all showed up for a press conference. None of the same showed up for the press conference about the death of Chicago police officer Luis Huestra. Luis was killed Sunday morning. It would have been the 21st. Luis Huestra is not only a former military man, he was an eight-year Chicago cop and was doing the right thing. Why the mayor and the appropriate authorities who were ready to implicate the cops just 2 weeks ago couldn't show up for one of their own is appalling to me. But we get into it now. And the reason I give you so much background up front is when this interview with Gary McCarthy was recorded, it was before Huestra was killed, frankly assassinated. So that's why we don't address it in the interview, but the content that Gary McCarthy brings you is directly relatable to all of it. So, with all of that knowledge, and the hope that you'll listen to the WLS show, 89 WLS, the Big 89, every morning between 5:30 and 9, however you get your radio, please listen, because we bring you these interviews all the time. Let's move forward with the full Gary McCarthy interview, and I think you'll agree that it will it'll inspire you for the right reasons, as we do that now on Live from My Office. Pleasure to talk with the superintendent, Gary McCarthy. Gary, tell everybody what you're doing lately. What are you doing now? Because you're doing it for the good people in the suburbs.
Yeah, I'm running the Willow Springs Police Department, which is in southwest suburbs. It's not an urban community, let's put it that way. It's much more of a pseudo-rural community. And it's a very small police department. As a matter of fact, I had more police officers in my squad when I was a 26-year-old sergeant in the Bronx. But having said that, I love it here.
Yeah, and the thing I like about it is you're bringing up the next generation of good cops, too, and showing them how it should be done. Just by way of establishing the track record, everybody knows you and everybody knows who you are, but they may have forgotten where you've worked and everything you've done from deputy what was the technical title in New York? Deputy Commissioner?
Deputy Commissioner Operations, yeah.
Yeah, Deputy Commissioner in New York to running the Newark Department, obviously running the department in Chicago at the Chicago Police Department. So I think we got a discussion here that's probably threefold. One is I certainly want to take on your leaving the job. Two is what police have to deal with now in doing their job, because nobody knows that better than you. And why don't we start with what happened last week? And that's Dexter Reed, this really messed up, troubled young man, as the Chicago Tribune put it, and another police video that was released. So what do you know about the Dexter Reed case before we get to the video?
Well, there was a reporter who got a version of all the videos, all the cameras, and made sure that I had it. And we did a quick interview right after the videos were released. The only things I know is what I'm seeing in the press. And, I'm very confused and disappointed by the way it was presented by the administration in Chicago to the public. I'm still uncertain why the police superintendent was not at that press conference. Larry Snelling, I'm not sure what's going on there, but I get asked this question probably 10 times a day. Yesterday, I played golf with a whole bunch of friends of mine, so I got asked this question about 30 times yesterday. You know,
Sure.
what's the deal with it? And I say very simply, don't shoot a police officer. Because we're trained to mitigate the threat. And that's when you stop shooting.
Yeah, and mitigating the threat is a really important part of this story because a core question that comes to everybody's minds is the lazy, underfunded reporting that goes on now. And I'm slamming the media for this because there are people who are working in A-line reporting and anchoring positions now who 10 or 20 years ago wouldn't have been hired. They don't have the experience, they don't have the connections, they don't have the networking. And if we heard about some of these stories going on where a cop to defend his or herself fired three times and not 16 times, to me, it would still be the same story. It's just the number of bullets is the flashpoint, and that's what the media jumps to immediately.
Yeah, and you know what, Steve? The thing that I say to people when they say, yeah, but what about 95 shots or 96 shots, however many it was? I say, well, let me ask you this question. Deadly physical force is one bullet. What if he got killed with one bullet? Would we still be having this discussion? Because that would have mitigated the threat right there. But it didn't. And, you know, apparently, I'm being told that there were 10 or 11 shell casings that were recovered from inside his vehicle. Now we saw where the cops were. They were 20, 30 yards away at some point. And obviously their shell casings are not going to be in the vehicle. So he fired everything that he had at the officers, and then he gets out of the car. And honestly, the end of the video that I saw with the officer firing from basically a straight line behind the car when he got out. You can't tell if he has something in his hand, and he's just been firing. You have a cop down already.
Right, and you're making split-second decisions to take care of the scenario, to mitigate, as you said, but also split-second decisions to protect your own life, so you get to go home that day.
Yeah, exactly right. And I'm very fortunate. I was a very active police officer. I went up through the ranks in the NYPD. I hope people realize that. Spent 25 years there. And when I went on the job, I had a friend in college who said, if I want to go to any particular precinct when I'm finishing my training, to give him a call, because his dad was a captain in the NYPD and said I could probably get you to wherever you want to go. And I said, okay, that's great. When I'm finishing up my training, I call him. I said, Howie, I want to go to the 4-6 precinct in the Bronx. He says, okay, 4-6, I got it. Calls me back 20 minutes later. He says, did you say 4-6? I said, yeah, why? He says, my dad wants to know if you actually took the psychological exam, because nobody asks to go to the 4-6. All you got to do is screw up and you end up there. And you know what, Steve? It was the best decision I made in my police career, because I didn't expect to do all the things that I did. You know,
Sure.
I looked at these old cranky white-haired sergeants and I said, man, I don't know if I could do that. But at the end of the day, if you're going to own a restaurant, you got to work in the kitchen first. You got to
Yes.
tables, and you have to learn the business from the ground up. And you know, I made an awful lot of arrests. I was a very active officer. I was a guy who old-timers didn't want to work with because they thought I was a black cloud. You know, at one point, two guys got into a shootout right over my vehicle, and I was like, "Hey, guys, you got to cut that out. It's you can take somebody's eye out with that thing." And
Right, right, right.
yeah, so I mean.
Well, I mean, and the thing is, what you describe is what good police leadership to me is, and good leadership in general. But in the case of the police, if you're not working the toughest neighborhoods, how are you learning the job?
You can't. You can't. And you know what, though, Steve? The other thing that it gave me was a confidence. I used to go on patrol when I was superintendent every Friday or Saturday night. And I would do the circuit. I would go all the way down south, come around up the west side, and hit all the really bad precincts, all the toughest districts. And my best conversations with police officers were at 4 o'clock in the morning on street corners in Englewood and West Lawndale.
Sure.
And they appreciated it because they knew that I appreciated them being out in the field with them and on the front line whenever I could be.
And literally the front line. The Tribune story about Derek Reed paints a much different picture than a lot of you may know or think. You know, the footage and the camera you're talking about shows officers getting out of an unmarked police vehicle, weapons drawn, and repeatedly ordering Reed to roll down the SUV's tinted windows. He initially complies. He doesn't roll down the passenger window. Moments later, Reed appears to shoot the CPD officer standing on the passenger side. The other four officers then do as they've been trained. They open fire, and Reed exits the vehicle and eventually falls to the pavement. And it's unclear whether he was still firing at that point. But this is not, and God bless him, but this is not a kid who was a choir boy. He was a very troubled young man, in and out of trouble all the time. He had been engaged in other incidents. He was shot and seriously injured previously in the commission of a crime. And what really makes me crazy is when I see quotes like this. Sharon Fairley, a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and a former chief administrator of COPPA, and we'll talk about what COPPA is in a second, said each of the four officers who fired their guns are going to be required to explain why they expended each round they fired. Here's her quote. The idea here is that the officer can't just discharge a firearm just because the colleague next to him or 10 feet away from him is discharging. They have to be able to identify a threat and use force and why they're using force in response to a specific threat themselves. That is one of the most insane quotes I've ever seen about a real-time situation where bullets are flying in the air. Because if you can't depend on your instincts as an officer and the training you've got, you certainly can't process it the way this professor from COPPA says the rules say you should process that incident. I mean, what can you say about that?
Well, I could say one thing. I can assure you that she's never been in a gun battle. And that, you know, the other thing is you would expect that somebody who was investigating police shootings would understand something called reflexive response, which is one guy fires, everybody fires. Okay. That didn't happen in this case, because one guy fires, everybody fires, the gun battle would have sounded like this, and it's over, right?
Right.
But
right.
It pop, 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 and it went back and forth, and it was staccato. And I kind of expected, when I heard that there were a lot of rounds fired, that that was going to be the case, that it was reflexive response, but it was not. And it went on, what a number, 41 seconds. What a coincidence. The other thing,
right.
Steve, is the gun was recovered in the vehicle.
Right.
And I know that because on the body cam that I saw, there's an officer who says, look, look, there's the gun right there. It's in the car. Now, mind you, the female officer who was on the driver's side of the vehicle in the initial stop, when Dexter is down, he's face down, and she's saying he's still got the gun, and she's trying to pull his hands out from underneath him so that they can get the gun. So they thought he still had the gun. And you're not going to make up a story in that amount of time.
Of course not.
So
as this investigation goes forward, answer a couple of quick questions for me. Why do these investigations take a year?
They shouldn't. They shouldn't take a year. When there's a homicide, or I should say murder, and someday, Steve, I'd love somebody to explain to the public that homicide means death at the hands of another. Murder is a sub classification under homicide. There's vehicular homicide, there's justifiable homicide, but everybody loves to say the medical examiner is classifying this case a homicide. Yes, it's death at the hands of another. I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, the question was why it takes a year.
Oh,
because to me, in a course of a year, memories fade, investigations lose their way, and different findings can be further from the truth than ever.
Well, because they're lazy, that's why. When a murder occurs, I don't know if you know this, but police officers, detectives, investigators will work 24/7 for probably at least a week or so on that case doing nothing else. And you have homicide teams that come in to support them to keep them going and getting these things done. COPPA works 9 to 5, and they might have a skeleton crew that comes out on midnights to see if there's anything else, if there happens to be another case. They don't work the way the police work, yet they're investigating police. And I'm guessing the reason why you asked that question is because one of the things that's very troubling to me is this issue of transparency. Because by releasing a video without any context, the officers hadn't made statements at that point. Yet the head of COPPA says, well, all we've got is a seatbelt violation. Now, where did they get that from? They didn't get it from the officers because they haven't made statements. And they couldn't have seen a seatbelt violation because the tinted windows were up, which is a very dangerous situation for a police officer. And if you watch the beginning of the video from start to finish, these men and women, jump into their vehicle and take off like the hammers of hell. And then they pull up in front of this vehicle. They didn't put on their lights and pull them over from behind. So there was something else afoot here. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it was, but we'll certainly find out. But that raises questions. And the other thing, and I'm sure you know this, Steve, is the first three reports from the scene are generally incorrect. And
yes, I've heard that.
When we start releasing information that is partial or hearsay or unconfirmed, we're causing more harm than good. This transparency thing is not working, you know?
No.
And to the point that I'm definitely going to make, which it sounds like you were going there, is why can't they just do an investigation, take a month, put the whole thing out there, if that's what they want to do? Which, by the way, Brandon Johnson didn't even realize that it's not up to him to release videos. It's the state's attorney's investigation. So,
And it goes to, and we'll talk about Laquan McDonald and your life in a second here as well. But I vividly remember a conversation we had where you spoke of your hands being tied, not about Jeffrey or about Van Dyke, not Jeffrey, but about any officer.
Yeah.
That because of the way the police department was structured in Chicago, you didn't have the power to fire an officer.
No.
There were multiple layers of discipline, like every whacked out HR department you've ever worked for in the corporate world, where you could even discipline somebody and how they had to be disciplined. And that's literally tying the hands of the management of the police to root out what everybody says. If you find a bad cop, you want the bad cop gone.
Yeah. And just to put a point on that, as superintendent, and I believe it's the same way today, I could only make a recommendation for a suspension of 30 days or more or termination to the police board. And during my first 4 years here in Chicago, 75% of my termination recommendations were denied by the police board. So here I am trying to fire bad cops, and I'm being told no by the process, which is being run by civilians.
All of this is political because people all bring agendas to the equation. When you're a cop doing your job, your agenda is to find the bad guys and get the bad guys, arrest the bad guys. The agendas of the courts and the state's attorney's office and other things have nothing to do with what you're doing. But for the life of me, and I know I get on this sermon every time you and I talk, I don't know how cops get up in the morning and go to work like you and your guys there, but certainly the folks that you commanded in the city and in New York and in Newark, when you don't have the support of the people that employ you. And I'm not talking about the greater community, because the greater community believes that they need the police. In the roughest neighborhoods, you know that's better than anybody, they want the cops there.
Oh, trust me, I know. You know, it's ironic. You know, to this day, probably in vicinity of 10 to 12 people a day come up and say something to me. And every single one says, we need you back. We wish you were mayor, so on and so forth. And this covers the gamut. It's black, white, Hispanic, tall, short, slim, and fat. You know what I mean? And I'm probably more popular to John Q. black man in Chicago than people would realize. The elected officials, they like to use it. But, you know, just the guy on the street. I took my son to the Willis Tower the other day for the first time. And I got out of an Uber, and there was a a senior black man who was sweeping up, obviously who worked for the building. And he looked and he goes, "Oh my God, it's you, McCarthy." And we started talking for about 5 minutes. Another man who was an usher at the Willis Tower came over, same thing, another black man. And, you know, they're like patting me on the back and shaking my hand and thanking me for everything. And my son, who's 7 years old, he's so accustomed to seeing this. It didn't make an impact on him at all. And, you know, that happens every day for me.
Right.
And like I said, I think I'm way more popular than people would think in the black community, because they know the difference between the number of gunshots they were hearing at night today versus what they heard back then.
Yeah, and this is not John Birch. This is not 1980 or 70 or 60. And by the way, it was never okay. No. But the way minorities are treated by the police, and this goes to a discussion because we could talk about this stuff all day, but it goes to ShotSpotter and how ridiculous the mayor's been in handling this. You don't put ShotSpotter sensors in Lake Forest because that's not where the gunshots are. Right. You put them where the crime has occurred, patterns show it's most likely to occur, and what could happen again. There's nothing racist about that. That's doing the job.
Well, you know, this is typical political backlash. And, you know, I always said that we're not taking the right medicine for what ails us. And if you go back, and we've had this discussion, the Adam Toledo shooting, you know, he's on the street with a gangbanger who's firing shots at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, which I think even in Chicago is a school night. A 13-year-old kid hanging out with the senior gangbanger. Gangbanger turns and gives the gun to the kid, who runs from the cops. Nothing good is going to come from that.
Exactly.
So instead of trying to figure out how to keep a 13-year-old off the street at 2 o'clock in the morning on a school night, instead of trying to figure out how to keep that kid away from a senior gangbanger and not running with a gun from the police, what are we going to do? We're going to eliminate ShotSpotter. What? You know what?
Exactly.
You have cancer. Take an aspirin.
Right. Why take away tools that the police department says they need? And the most ridiculous argument there, again, comes from a college professor, this one at Northwestern, who again hasn't been involved in a gun battle, who said, well, our studies show that ShotSpotter only results in convictions about 10% of the time. You tell me any of those neighborhoods that don't want police responding, even if it's a dumpster door closing, because it might be a shot. Of course they do.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because there's so much of it in the disenfranchised communities, generally, they might not even call 911 for shots fired because they're so accustomed to hearing them. And that's not their fault. It's just the way it is.
This all ties back into what happened with you after 4 years of running the Chicago Police Department.
No, and, I made it to five, Steve. I made it to five.
It wasn't full five? Okay. Congratulations. Sorry we didn't get you a watch. And the Laquan McDonald case. Laquan McDonald was a kid that also had a tremendous amount of troubles going on in his life. And you said from the beginning, your heart hurts for all of these kids who are messed up and get into these positions and make terrible choices that could end up costing them their lives. Somewhere along the way, people like Pastor Corey Brooks on the West Side, who are trying to build a center and trying to give kids different alternatives instead of gangbanging, God bless them, and they deserve to be supported. But when this all went down, you have a little bit of history that you can explain in the shortest possible way with Mayor Emanuel and how he hired you and what your relationship was in running the city on the police side.
You know, everybody, it was interesting because I had worked for Rudy Giuliani first, right, in New York as deputy commissioner. And when people were telling me about Rahm Emanuel being difficult to work with, I said, well, I worked with this guy, Rudy. I could probably work with him also. And it was interesting because I can tell you that 99.9% of the decisions that were made in the police department during my tenure were my decisions. I could think of exactly one decision where they asked me, his chief of staff said, Gary, do me a favor, just go along with this. I have to, we need this. This is a political thing that we absolutely need. And I said, okay, and I went along with it. And by the way, it was a mistake. It certainly rubbed me the wrong way because I feel like I was giving up my integrity. But I can tell you that, you know, I had to argue with him frequently, but 99% of the time I got exactly what I asked for. And you know, I think he's just contrarian, let's put it that way, where he you know, he
But he
devil's
did
advocate.
say, as you've said to me, he did say, I want you to be, and not these specific words, but I want you to be cognizant of the politics that I have to deal with, but I want you to run the department. That was generally the operating orders, right?
Yeah, and that actually came out more out of my mouth than the other direction when I took the job. I said, Mayor, I'll keep your politics in mind, but I really need to make all the decisions in the department. To his credit, he agreed to it, and he actually stuck to it over the years. I had to remind him of it frequently, but by the same token, you know, different people might have caved to that very easily. And sorry, you know, I'm a Taurus, I'm Irish, and I'm a linebacker. So, you know, it's pretty difficult once I dig my heels in.
You may have been stubborn once or twice, but for the right reasons. So in the case of Laquan McDonald, I hold in my hand the City Council, City of Chicago Finance Committee report and minutes from the April 13th, 2015 meeting, specifically about the settlement with the Laquan McDonald family. This is a fairly short document, 15 or so pages. Five paragraphs in, we get to the money shot, if you will. And the money shot is, and I'll read it directly, the law department recommends that a claim be settled for $5 million, inclusive of attorney fees and costs. And a man named Steve Patton, who is the city attorney in this particular situation, says, I'll explain why we think that settlement makes sense for the city and taxpayers later in this document. When that decision was made, there'd been no hearings. There'd been no discussions of what happened. I don't even know that the investigation had reached its end. So, can you fill in any blanks for me there?
There was also something else that nobody realizes. There was no lawsuit filed by the family.
Ever.
They approached the city sometime near the end of March, and by the middle of April, Steve Patton is in front of the City Council Finance Committee with a settlement. In that document, he goes through all the actions of every officer, or most of the officers that were relevant. And he never mentions the fact that in the agreement that he's making with the family, that there's a direction that they are not to release evidence in the case. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, first of all, CPD does not investigate its own uses of force. As you stated, it goes to COPPA. But COPPA only does administrative investigations. They can't lock people up. They don't have police powers. If they find something that they think is criminal, they turn it over to the state's attorney. The state's attorney is the one who determines whether or not there's going to be charges. In this case, Anita Alvarez took a severe hit because the U.S. attorney at the time, Zach Farden, impaneled a federal grand jury, which supersedes the state's grand jury.
Sure.
Anita's waiting for Farden to make a decision. He doesn't make a decision. A judge orders that the agreement with the family gets overturned, and the video will be released. The agreement was made between Steve Patton and the family of and the lawyers for the family of Laquan McDonald on the civil side. The criminal investigation is still ongoing with the state's attorney and the U.S. attorney. Anita makes a decision that she's going to announce charges against Van Dyke when she hears that the video is going to be released because she knows it's about to hit the fan. Farden never finishes his grand jury. In 2022, the U.S. attorney released a statement saying that they determined that they were not going to file any charges. 2022. The shooting happened in 2014. So
Years.
unbelievable how the system actually functions. And then we wonder why it's all screwed up.
Yeah, well, a complete dereliction of duty.
Yeah.
But to get back to the release of the video, you've stated on multiple occasions you knew it was a problem for the entire time, but you aren't able to release the video. It doesn't fall under your purview. And in this city council meeting where the $5 million payday is announced up front, the layout of the what led to the shooting specifically, in my view, defends the police actions almost entirely, and the McDonald acted in a way that made him a significant threat. It was only a few feet from Van Dyke when Van Dyke opened fire. Now, we can talk about the shots, and we will, but by the same token, the police did their job as I see it here. Do you read anything in this report that says differently?
No. And you know, seeing so the shooting happened on a Monday night, and I would have my executive staff meetings on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So we didn't have another executive staff meeting until Wednesday. And whenever there was a police-related shooting, I implemented a system where the executive staff at the same time would get an update and a review of any police-related shootings that had happened in the prior couple of days. So I got a phone call Monday night telling me that we had shot a kid with a knife on the southwest side, and that was pretty much it. So when I spoke to Ron the next morning at 6 o'clock, because he called every morning at 6 o'clock, I told him that it happened. I said, I'll get you details when I have more. Wednesday, when I saw the video, first of all, it was a deafening silence in the room. But I asked the question. I said, how many, because there was no audio on it. I asked the question, how many shots did he fire? And they said 16. And I said, you mean he didn't even save one for himself if he got captured? I mean, and I might have thrown a couple of expletives in there. I got up from my seat, I walked inside, and I called the mayor, and I told him, I said, we have a problem. And I told him, there were 16 shots fired, the video is horrific, we got a problem. And there was a deafening silence on the phone, real long, pregnant pause. And then he said, is there anything else going on? That was the end of the conversation that I had with him.
And you knew it was a problem, you stated it was a problem at the time.
Yep, absolutely.
So this, again, the details that this is laid out implicate nobody other than the shooter and the decisions he made in the end, and that the report, as it was laid out, to me, there's two things that jump out. One is the payment before anybody says anything in a separate conversation with the family. In other words, in TV, hour-long drama terms, make it go away.
Right.
Just make it go away. And the city has paid millions and millions over and over again to do just that, frankly, to serve politics, but not to serve the people of the city of Chicago. And each time it happens, it's a kick in the crotch for every cop that goes out there and has taken one for the team, literally. When you left as a superintendent, Rahm Emanuel said, if I remember the statement correctly, this has nothing to do with performance. It's about trust in the police department. What do you want to say about that?
Oh, you know, it's interesting because when he called me in, he asked me, he called me in on Monday, and it was November 30th, I guess, because on December 1st, if you remember, on the first of the month, I would generally do early press, and I'd bounce from all the different stations to the next ones. And he said to me, so Gary, what are we going to do? And I started explaining to him what I had been doing for the previous couple of months, which was a community relations strategy. We had narcotics strategies, we had gun strategies, we had robbery strategies. Nobody ever had a community relations strategy, which we put together, where I went around the city talking to various communities, asking them what they expected from the police and what they wanted. So I started explaining all of this to him, and he said, wait. He says, you know what, Gary, let's talk about this tomorrow. But first he said, what are we going to do? And I said, about what? And he says, well, 40% of the city doesn't trust you. I said, who is that? He says, the African-Americans. And I said, no, they don't trust you. And he said, yeah, well, what are we going to do? And that's when I explained the strategy. And when he told me, let's talk about it tomorrow, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. This is not my first rodeo. I know what's going on here.
Right.
And actually on Sunday night, I had a conversation with them. So Sunday night, I have a conversation with him. When I hung up the phone, I told my wife, Kristen, I said, I'm going to get fired. Monday, he calls me in. Tuesday, in the middle of my interviews, he calls me in and he says, come on in, let's talk. And I told him, I said, look, I'm going to WGN. It's my last interview. I said, you want me to skip it? And he said, yeah. I said, okay. I looked at my driver and I said, okay, let's go get fired. And I went into his office and I said, I guess you don't want to hear the plan. And he said, no, I don't. I think you should resign. It's in the best interest of the city. And went on like a 2-minute diatribe. And when he was all done, I said, no. He said, no, what? I said, no, I'm not going to resign. I didn't do anything wrong. And, you know, okay, here's the other thing, Steve. Monday morning at 5 o'clock, when I get in my truck, my press guy is in the back seat and he hands me a copy of the Sun-Times. And there's a front page editorial by Jim Kirk, right? I think he was dead.
Yep. Runs Cranes now.
Calling for my resignation or termination, using pretty much the same exact words that Rahm used on Monday afternoon. I mean, really quite a coincidence, don't you think?
Yeah, and very much so.
Each one of the news stations that I went to, the first thing that the reporter did was they would hold up the paper and say, are you going to resign? And I told every one of them, I said, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not a quitter, and we're going to get by this thing. And when I went back to Ron's office and he asked me to resign, and I told him no. He called in his guy, David Spielfogel, who tried to talk me into resigning. I said, no, I'm not doing it. He says, well, I want to tell people that we came to this decision together. I said, well, we haven't. He says, eventually he goes, well, I'm the mayor and that's what I want to do. And I said, you can do whatever you want. And those are the last words I said to him. There might've been an expletive in there at the same time.
Sure.
Later that afternoon, his chief of staff calls me and says, you know, can we have a conversation? We got to do some paperwork. I said, what paperwork? She says, well, your letter of resignation. I said, did you talk to the mayor about this? And she said, yeah, but it's not happening. This went on for 17 days. Every day.
That I did not know. So they kept waiting and coming back to it.
Yeah, they kept calling me and saying, are you going to resign? Are you going to resign? And I said, no. And on that was on December 1st when he, quote unquote, asked me to resign. And it was on December 17th when Franz Spielman filed a FOIA request for my letter of resignation, which didn't exist. So Eileen Mitchell, his chief of staff at the time, I think he went through like six of them, called me and asked if I was going to resign. I said, come on, Eileen, you know better than that. She said, well, do you want a letter of termination? I said, no, but if that's what you choose to do, that's up to you. So I got a letter of termination signed by Eileen Mitchell, not even by Rahm.
Well, you never signed it.
No. And it was emailed to me, and I emailed it to my wife right away with the comment, can you believe this? He didn't even have the balls to do it himself. And when they FOIA'd the Freedom of Information Act regarding my emails regarding Laquan McDonald, I was on exactly 2 of the hundreds of emails that went back and forth in City Hall regarding Laquan McDonald. My email to my wife was there, and that became front page in the Tribune and the Sun-Times, which I know kind of came off.
The details get foggy for people at the end of the news cycle. Here we are a few years later. You have always been an honest guy, and you've always been up front with me. You're always available to talk about these things. And I know you love this city. You've made a home here. Is there anything you would have done differently in how you did your job or process that case from your department and your office?
I don't think so. You know, I had limitations based upon the law, what I could and couldn't do. And what I've tried to explain to people, and naturally, you know, there are people who just are never going to accept anything. Mm-hmm. If I released evidence that was part of a federal grand jury, the U.S. attorney would delight to indict a police chief.
Big story.
For compromising an investigation. So, and besides which, people don't even know that it was the practice at the time not to release evidence in a police-related shooting or any other investigation that the state's attorney was involved in. So in my mind, I did exactly what I was supposed to do. I notified my superior about the issues. We reviewed the tactics. And in doing so, we would come up with recommendations of how to knock down police-related shootings, which we did. And I believe they were down about 75% during my 5-year tenure.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I remember that number. You smacked in the face at all by the irony of the fact that We were talking about not releasing evidence in Dexter Reed's case, and this stated need for transparency, because that doesn't seem all that transparent to me.
No, it's not. First of all, by not completing an investigation, you're doing a disservice to everybody, whether it's Dexter Reed, his family, or the officers who are involved, or the public at large. You're doing a disservice because there are people who love the cops, there's people who hate the cops, and there's people who can go either way in between, right? And we're poisoning the well. We're putting information out there that is not given context. It's not given a story. The officers haven't made statements yet. Yet the head of COPA is saying it was a seatbelt violation. Well, you can't have it both ways. If they can't make statements, you can't say what they were thinking and why they did what they did. But that's what she did.
Selective transparency. And France Bielman, I'm glad you brought her up. She wrote a piece about this and, well, a number of pieces about this, which I'd recommend for people as well. Let me ask you a couple of basic questions, and I'll give you a chance to wrap up anything that we didn't talk about because I've already kept you too long. One of the things that jumped out of one of these stories was the lack of tasers, and how tasers weren't standard operating equipment. I could be misremembering this, but I feel like one of the first conversations you and I had when we talked about changes to the department, it's one of the things you wanted to see happen, that the cops would be equipped with tasers. Was that a budget thing that they weren't?
No, I don't think it was a budget thing. Sergeants had tasers. Two things that still rile me up is the fact that during the entirety of the event with Laquan McDonald, which I don't even know how many minutes it went on, but the two officers who responded to the job did a magnificent job. One got out of the car and was following him on foot. McDonald went over and stabbed the tires of the police car.
In front of a cop. Textbook de-escalation by the cops.
They stayed with him and they put it over the radio. Not one supervisor took command of what was going on, which really troubles me. And that was the individual who had the taser. Okay. So sometimes they screw up. Sometimes they do it on purpose because they don't want any accountability or liability. And in this case, a lot of people paid the price for it.
There was a big deal made at the time and at different times about if tasers had been present and if everybody had them, maybe no shots are fired. In the real world, that's not how these things tend to go down. But should they be standard operating procedure in big city cops?
Yeah. As should be body cams. By the way, people don't even know, but I'm the one who implemented body cams in Chicago.
100%.
So,
when you do traffic stops, I've talked to a number of Chicago cops that work for you through the years and cops that are still on the job about this. And they laugh at the idea that they're rolling as racist, just looking to find a black person or a brown person or whatever. And they said, Steve, drive down the road, pass a car, tell me who drove it. He said, when we pull somebody over, it's because they have done something that is relevant to be stopped for. It's not a profiling. They're being pulled over because we have a reason to pull them over. Anything you can add to that?
Oh, sure. I actually wrote a paper about this. Probably around 2016. We did a 2-year study on the quote unquote stop and frisk issue. And it turns out that in all of the 77 neighborhoods across the city of Chicago, who we stopped, where we stopped, and when we stopped exactly matched arrests and complaints. So let me put that in real simple terms. The population in Englewood is somewhere around 98% African American. Okay. If there's a white guy who lives there, the ACLU wants to make sure that we stop him 33% at a time because that's the city's population. That makes no sense at all. And that is not serving the people because we respond to crime complaints. We profile crime complaints. In Englewood, 100% for a 2-year period, shootings, robberies, and murders. Description of the offender was African American, right? So just hold on to that for a second. If you go up to the 19th district, up by Boys Town and places like that, 58%, I think, 58% of the robberies were committed by African Americans, but only 6% of the population up there is African American. Oh, we got you. We got you because you're stopping 58% African Americans. Within 1 or 2 percentage point, who we stopped, where we stopped, and when we stopped exactly matched the crime trends. That's why in 2013 and 2014, we had the lowest numbers in the city since 1965. It's called data-driven policing. Okay. And that includes things like a gang book, right? Where we know who are the gangs, who are the gang members, what turfs they own, and who they're in conflict with. Because the way that we cut down the shootings were if you're a Red Hot Chili Pepper and this is your territory, and you get into a beef with somebody in a different group in a different area, we know who's in conflict and where the shooting happens. It's not where everybody goes. We go to the rival gang's turf and we catch these guys going to retaliate. Because the first thing we say is, where's the retaliation going to take place? It's not going to be at the scene, it's going to be at the other place. Data-driven policing. So what
It's
did we do?
preemptive.
We
It's
got
preemptive. It's preemptive,
everything.
not reactionary then. And
Yeah.
can you do that kind of policing when you're 2,000 cops down or whatever the current number is?
You have to do that type of policing. But the problem is we got rid of the gang database. That happened at the Lightfoot. And now we want to get rid of ShotSpotter. Let's just make sure we get rid of everything. And like I said, don't try and fix the problem. Just try and stop the police from doing their job. And by the way, the officer who was involved in that shooting, absolutely devastated. And everybody talks about well-being of officers. Nonsense.
Well, and we see officer suicides from the pressure of the job and all the things that go with it as well. Last question, and then anything else you want to add, but the number of shots fired piece. I go back to being in the FBI Citizens Academy and the eye-opening thing that that was for me. It puts you on a simulator. It's nothing like the real world, but you're on a sim. You got to decide in a split second if a bad guy has a gun and he's going to do something. You fire the shots in the sim, and then they ask you how many shots you fired. Invariably, you say three, four, and invariably, it's 15 or 20. Y
Right.
you train to be a cop in those situations. How do you train a cop not to fire 16 times? I mean, that to me seems counterintuitive when the job is to mitigate the situation, meaning take out the person who could take out you and your fellow officers or innocent bystanders.
Well, I think the problem that we have is our training is cookie cutter. In New York, we would go to the range 50 at a time, 50 spots across a range. And they tell you fire two, fire three, fire two, fire three. And in between, you're supposed to be assessing the situation. Different people react in different ways to stress. Knock on wood, so far in my 43-year career, I've never fired my gun except for at the range. And I made lots of gun arrests, let's put it that way.
Amazing thinking about where you've been.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I made five gun arrests as a superintendent. There's nothing like it, quite frankly, because you did something good. But there was one time where I thought I fired a shot and I didn't because I was I'm pulling the trigger and all of a sudden I realized there's somebody sitting on this car and the gun went up in the air. I thought it was the recoil. And we had revolvers at the time. And after we grabbed the guy with the gun, I checked my gun and the cylinder had actually turned. That's how far I had pulled the trigger, but I let it go. So that's the closest I ever came, although there were a number of times that I came almost that close. But different people react to stress in different ways. I've always had this thing, and maybe it's from playing a lot of sports, that in stressful situations, it's almost like things slow down for me. It's like a high-speed camera. When that camera's going, you look at it and it's in slow motion. And all the crisis that I've been involved in over the course of my career. So, not everybody has that experience. And I'm not ever going to make an excuse for an officer who. I'm never going to make an excuse for Jason Van Dyke. I'm never going to make an excuse for him. But I also understand that he probably didn't even realize he fired 16 shots, just like you just said.
Yeah, but the reaction is, and everybody is different in how they do it. And I assume over the course of an officer's career, you can find out in incidents that hopefully don't lead to what happened in the Laquan McDonald case, if somebody is not right for that job, and maybe they do something else.
And the other thing, Steve, I want you to go back and take a look at the video of that shooting, and I'm sure you can find it. And what happens is, first of all, like I said, this thing went on for a good 5 minutes with the two officers following him. And then, you know, you see Laquan McDonald's back and he's in front of the car, and you see a police car pull up in front of him. And when he turns towards him, they take off. And then another car pulls in from a different direction into the same exact spot. That's Van Dyke, who gets out of the car, and he's in a tactically inferior position, and he fires. Good tactics prevent bad shootings.
Yeah. So that's a violation of the training that for whatever reason, he didn't execute it at that point. Is there anything we didn't cover?
I just want to kind of make it clear, because you talked about the City Council Finance Committee. Steve Patton did not tell the City Council Finance Committee that there was an agreement not to release evidence in the case, i.e.
Never brought it up. He never brought it up.
Never brought it up. Yet, in the agreement with the family, it's paragraph 5, just like the money, paragraph 5, that they are not going to release anything to the public. So Patton, in that City Council Finance Committee, tells them that Van Dyke acted within the scope of his authority. Now, I'm sorry, but I know that murder is not within the scope of an officer's authority. And a year later, when Patton's leaving, he does an exit interview with Fran Spielman. Again, she comes up. I'm going to have to give Fran a call, right?
Right.
He does an exit interview where he says, and this is pretty much a quote, he says, "I thought then, and it's been borne out now, that it was a case of murder." Well, that's not what he told the City Council Finance Committee.
Not at all.
The word murder.
And it's right here. And it's right there in black and white. It exists on the page.
The entirety of that cover-up is right there. They got $5 million and were asked not to release the video, which they agreed to, which is why a judge had to unseal the video. Nobody ever asked a question. Why did you need a judge to unseal the video?
Right. And there's your answer.
It was done on the civil side, not on the criminal side. And I wasn't even in charge of the criminal investigation. But I had to find a way to support my family.
I know you've made a life here in Chicago, and you love Chicago.
Yeah.
Would you take another big city job somewhere?
That's tough, because I've got a 7-year-old now. We've got a beautiful house and a great neighborhood. Kristen is networked to the max as a lawyer here in Chicago. So I don't know if that would be in the cards. Plus, you know, I'm going to be 65 in a couple of weeks. Maybe Willow Springs is the right place for me now. And not,
well, listen, not you're doing a great job there, but 65 ain't what it used to be. When you and I were kids, 65 was, I can see dead from here. Now it's later middle age, and I'm right behind you.
Steve, you don't know what's going on in here.
What about politics? Ever run again?
No. It's the most distasteful thing I've ever done in my life. To listen to two things, first of all. To just ask people for money is not part of my being. I'm the guy, when I lived in apartment 710 on Ontario Street, I wouldn't go to the people in 709 and ask them for a cup of sugar. I would get in my car and drive to Jewel and buy some sugar, right? So that's the first thing. But the listening to candidates and how many forums I went to as a mayoral candidate, and listening to them again speaking half-truths and sometimes outright lies, and then correcting them publicly, and then you go to the next one and you listen to them say it again. It's infuriating. Yeah. It's absolutely infuriating.
That's exactly why we need people to vote, because the system is broken, and the only way to fix it is to get rid of those that broke it.
Yeah. And the other thing, yeah, you're exactly right. People have to get out and vote. Thankfully, Kim Fox is leaving, and Eileen O'Neill Burke is coming in.
Yeah, I'm optimistic.
But I was worried especially when 10,000 votes appeared out of nowhere.
Right.
People are still telling me, welcome to Chicago. And that's what they're talking about. 12 years later, or 13. What is it? It's 13 years. My God, I didn't realize that.
Gary McCarthy, former Chicago superintendent, running the police department in Willow Springs. And always a pleasure. I appreciate the conversation. I know I kept you a long time, but here on the podcast and also on WLS, people need to hear this stuff. And I'm glad you're out there.
Thank you, Steve. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Always.
Former Superintendent McCarthy will be back. He's a good guest. He always is available, and he says what needs to be said, the truth, and the truth about being a cop in the city. And it doesn't just have to be Chicago. It could be New York, where he was a cop forever. It could be Newark, where he served. It could be wherever you have police who do this in small towns and large. So thank you to Superintendent McCarthy, Chief McCarthy now in the burbs here in Chicago. In the meantime, wherever you listen, I thank you for listening. I thank Ross Cochran for being the producer of Live from My Office, and I hope you'll listen next time. Another big-name guest will join us then, and we'll see you on 890 WLS every morning between 5:30 and 9, however you get your radio. Subscribe, rate, review the podcast, download it, show your grandfather, your grandmother how to do the same, and we'll talk to you next time on Live from My Office.
Thank you for listening to Live from My Office, a service of Monkey Run Productions. All rights reserved. The podcast is hosted by Steve Cochran, and it's mixed, edited, and produced by me, Ross Cochran. Steve is available for corporate speaking gigs. He would love to MC your event. And occasionally, he's funny. Thank you for listening. Head to CochranShow.com for more.